It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mike Wershagen, in for Kevin Gavin. Road tests of some self-driving cars remain on pause across the country while authorities continue to investigate a fatal crash in Arizona involving Uber. Arizona officials say they're parking all autonomous vehicles indefinitely, but it might not be so simple in Pennsylvania. And the Pittsburgh Pirates opened their 2018 season today in Detroit. The first pitch follows a rain delay on Thursday and an offseason that bid farewell to two beloved players. Low morale and long odds for the Buccos. That's coming up. But first, thousands of Americans turned out last weekend for the largest youth-led protest since the Vietnam War. What did March for Our Lives accomplish, and what are students and lawmakers taking away from this renewed effort against gun violence? Journalists from Pittsburgh and the Capitol join us to talk about what's next. Ben Schmidt is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Stephanie Strasberg is a photojournalist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And The Washington Post's John Woodrow Cox is on the line from D.C. Welcome to you all.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
A reminder, you can join the conversation too. Reach us on Twitter using the hashtag WESAConfluence and via email, confluence@wesa.fm. March for Our Lives was the brainchild of, well, children. A group of survivors from the Parkland High School shooting that left 17 people dead earlier this year are using their platform to create a movement. Some estimates suggest they brought together more than 1 million people across hundreds of cities. Ben, you attended the event in Pittsburgh. What did you see?
You know, Mike, I saw a lot more people than I expected. I think they anticipated the crowd to be 3,000, and estimates were as high as 30,000. Just a lot of passion. A lot of signs, obviously, and various ages and races. I mean, I think I saw newborns to people up in their 70s. It was quite a sight. Market Square was completely jam-packed.
Stephanie, you were there as well.
Yeah, I think the students that I met, they really wanted to be taken seriously. For a lot of them, this was really a life-changing experience to be out there with the kind of energy that was brought. They got to lead the whole march. They had teenagers and high schoolers at the front of the march leading this thousands and thousands of people. So, you know, they're at a point in their life where they don't want to hear that they're just kids anymore. They want their opinions to be taken seriously, and they're sick of waiting for somebody else to make the changes that they want to see in their world.
They also have, in protests around the country, brought up a few specific things they want to see. They want to see, some of their goals include a ban on assault-style rifles, expanded background checks, a higher minimum age for firearms purchases. Is that something you heard echoed here in Pittsburgh?
I definitely heard that, and I saw that on a lot of the signs were themed that way with all those points you just made.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that students also really want politicians to no longer accept money from the NRA. They've grown up with shows like The Daily Show and people like John Oliver. And I think that's one of the things that's allowed them to do is see that you need to follow the money. And I think that a lot of the students at the front of this that are moving this forward understand that until the money gets divested, nothing is going to really change as far as the political system goes.
WESA spoke to a handful of teens both before and after the march.
We saw it. We realized, hey, this didn't just happen to them. It happens to us all the time. It just didn't happen on a larger scale like it did to them.
Yeah.
But
it was a wake-up call.
Yeah.
The march is just like the starting point. So it's now we're all united. We just need to sit down and start brainstorming other ideas that can get our voices heard and get change happening.
The organizers were stressing, like, they want Congress and politicians all across the country to, like, really do something, and they're really pushing for change. And I think we can all kind of relate to that because we've just been seeing it become a norm. Wanting to, like, push for change because of something so tragic on a national level is, like, really important, and that's what I support.
That was Rhea Gadania Carter, Ava Karras, Ray Prunty, and Jordan Schmidt. Ben, that last name should sound pretty familiar to you.
That's right. That's my 18-year-old daughter. I'm very proud of her.
So what is it like being the father of two girls who attend a school that has lost students to gun violence? And does that make it more difficult for you to cover these things, or does it give you sort of a better understanding of the people you're talking to?
Actually, the answer to that is both. I mean, I think that you understand what's gone on in that high school. And let me say that the shootings weren't in the high school, but they lost students to gun violence from the high school in various neighborhoods. So they definitely have been impacted by this for a long time. So the other thing is just trying to still remain objective as a news person, which I do. But, you know, she decided to go to the march in D.C., and I was, of course, encouraging.
Stephanie, you've spent a lot of time with students at Woodland Hills in particular. What have they done? And as Ben said, these were not shootings at the school, but it is still losing a young person to gun violence. What have they done in the wake of these tragedies?
They're very organized there, and they're really moving forward with a lot of different activities in the next year to come, including they're planning a town hall. They're doing a voter registration drive. They are doing a mural to honor the memories of local lives lost, and they're doing assemblies on healing and safety, in addition to taking part in the national walkouts scheduled again for April 20th. So they're focused not only on moving forward politically, but healing as a school and as a community. And they've really rallied around the families there who have been affected by gun violence, including Sierra Turner, who is 16 and lost her twin brother, Jeremy, who's very involved in the organizing. Her mother is very involved as a mentor. So they're all, they're looking to build curriculum around healing and around dealing with the trauma in school. So it's, for them, it's on a local level and a national level.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, I have another daughter who's on the high school basketball team, who is on the team with Sierra Turner. So it's impossible not to, you know, cover these events and still meet these people on other levels that are dealing with things like that. The other thing is they had the walkout in March along with all the other high schools, and the Trib fanned out to various high schools, and I covered the Woodland Hills one because I live close to there. I think there were 500 students that walked out, and the school was very accommodating, but that was something to see as well.
Yeah, and the number of people participating has, in the wake of Parkland, has been larger than what we've seen before. And some of the crowd estimates out there say that more than 1 million people attended these marches nationwide. There was a remarkable story published in the Washington Post last Sunday that gives us an idea about why so many people turned out and why this has affected so many people. John, can you tell us what you found?
Sure. So we spent the last year, I've been covering this issue over the past year, just the impact of gun violence on children all across America, both in schools and neighborhoods and sort of in every way. Excuse me. And what we found was that, sorry.
No problem.
What we found in this analysis was that going back to Columbine in 1999, there had been more than 187,000 students who had experienced a school shooting on their campus during that period. And this is, you know, K through 12. And we took a really very narrow definition of that. It had to be during school hours. You know, we didn't count even accidental shootings in which no one was injured. So we tried to look at this sort of as narrowly and defensively as we could. And that still was an enormous number, 187,000. That's, 190 plus schools all over the country. And, we often tend to focus on these sort of Parkland events or Columbine or Sandy Hook, but kids are exposed to gun violence in and around their schools much more frequently, I think, than people realize.
Yeah, 187,000. If you put them all together, they'd be Pennsylvania's third largest city.
Right.
Just kids who've experienced right. These shootings. So what is life like for them in the days, months, years after this happens?
You know, I wrote about a school shooting last year in South Carolina that almost no one remembers. There was a 14-year-old who pulled up on the playground during recess and opened fire on a group of first graders. He shot a teacher in the shoulder, hit another student in the foot, and then hit a little boy in the leg, and he died. That child died. And because only one child died, very few people remembered this. It got very little coverage outside of the state of South Carolina. And I went back 8 months afterwards. The shooting was in 2016, and I went back the middle of last year, and those kids were wrecked. I mean, they were absolutely wrecked, dealing with debilitating PTSD, and one girl couldn't go to school anymore. She's homeschooled and on really significant medications. Another little boy who I circled back with his mother just a couple of weeks ago, and he's still dealing with overwhelming amounts of guilt that he left, you know, that he didn't stay and help his friend. So, you know, and that's not uncommon. You know, I spent time in Las Vegas with teenagers who were at the shooting there, and they're still all these months later dealing with enormous amounts of PTSD. People who survived Columbine are still dealing with really traumatic memories, and you know, and it affects them every day. So these things stick with kids, even if they don't hear the gunshots. It can stick with them for years, decades afterwards.
Yeah, and you mentioned Columbine. One of the people that you talked to was Samantha Haviland. She survived Columbine when she was 16, and she's now working as the director of counseling for Denver Public Schools. So she survived this traumatic event. She told you that she was experiencing some of the after effects, and yet she's gone into a career of working with traumatized children. Did she tell you why she chose that line of work?
You know, she had already wanted to do that, and this really solidified her desire to do it. But, you know, it was really fascinating to me that she is somebody who understands the science. She understands all the complexity of trauma, and she still dealt with survivor's guilt and didn't get therapy on her own for 9 years. And this is while she's going through her undergrad and grad and going to get her PhD, and she still never was compelled. She thought, you know, all these other kids, I lost friends, others were shot, you know, I didn't get shot. And so there was this guilt that she didn't deserve to get therapy. And so, you know, despite the fact that, you know, nobody on earth would have a better understanding of, you know, what it requires to cope with these things, she still was reluctant to do that. And the only thing that led her to do it was one day she was in the library. They had an active shooter drill. So she was sitting with a group of students, high schoolers, who had no idea that she was a survivor of Columbine. The lights were off, and she sees she hears the footsteps of the administrator who's checking the doors to make sure they're all locked, and she just had a total panic attack. And finally, that's what compelled her to say, you know, I need to get help on my own. But, you know, even now, 19 years later, she's still dealing with really, you know, significant issues from that.
Yeah. You know, Columbine seems like an awfully long time ago, and this has happened again and again and again. We kind of got used to this script. You know, shootings happen, there are candlelight vigils, there are calls for gun control, there are accusations of politicizing a tragedy, there are recriminations back and forth. And then something else happens and it knocks it out of the news. That is not happening this time. It's been a month and a half, and we're still focused on this. I mean, Ben, what's different?
I just think that the reaction of the Parkland students, you know, propelled this into a different stratosphere. I mean, I think that they were so vocal so early on, well, maybe in some cases other kids weren't, that it's just it got everybody's attention, even the people who are attacking those kids. Everybody's paying attention. And you're right, it's been going on for a while, and there's still no end in sight.
Now, we tend to get you see more coverage of mass shootings like Columbine, Sandy Hook, Parkland. These are majority white schools. And John, you wrote that, you know, they do get the most attention, but you also found that children of color are more likely to be victims of gun violence. How much more likely?
Yeah, much more likely. In fact, you know, Hispanic students are twice as likely and black students are three times as likely. And, you know, we don't hear about those shootings, I think, for a couple of reasons. And one is that those shootings tend to not be indiscriminate. You know, the really scary shootings are the ones like Parkland, where, you know, a kid is going in and just shooting people at random. And the shootings that minority students tend to deal with are targeted, that, you know, a kid brings a gun to school to shoot a principal, to shoot another kid, to shoot a girlfriend who's dumped him. And those, you know, just because of the sheer numbers, are, you know, they don't get as much attention. But I think, too, there is, you know, bias toward kids who grow up in high crime communities that we just don't spend, we the media, we, you know, politicians, lawmakers, just sort of society doesn't give as much attention to kids in those environments because there's just sort of this expectation that they're desensitized, that this is just part of their life. And, you know, I think that is a part of it, too, and that's really unacceptable, you know, because the trauma that those kids can suffer can often be worse. That chronic sort of violence is often much more impactful.
Right. You mentioned that, and you bring up an interesting point there. Is it different for a kid to see a targeted shooting in his school than it is for a kid to see a random shooting in his school?
You know, I think a lot of the trauma can be the same. You know, I talk to kids, you know, I spent time in Chicago with a kid who'd been shot in an act of gang violence. I've spent time with a four-year-old in Cleveland who'd been shot in the head in a road rage incident. You know, these first graders in South Carolina, the teenagers out in Las Vegas. And, you know, the symptoms were often very consistent. I do think, though, there is something worse about a constant threat of violence than just a single event, that it can, and the research backs that up, you know, that these kids who live in what they call a state of hypervigilance, that they, even in their schools, they will have their backs to the walls all the time, and they can't really even explain why, that it's just a defense mechanism. And the idea that, you know, you could perceive threats, perceive danger all around you all the time, and then also try to learn and try to take SAT tests and try to, you know, go on and go to college is just absurd. The fact that, you know, the idea that we could ask kids to grow up in these environments where they're constantly in fear and succeed academically, I mean, that is such an enormous challenge. And, you know, this is an issue that goes beyond the kids now who are directly experiencing school shootings. It is because, you know, kids now, active shooter drills, all those sorts of things, and those can create a lot of fear. You know, there was a kid we wrote about in Birmingham. He's in sixth grade, and he had not gone through a school shooting himself, but he had heard about Parkland. There was another girl in Birmingham who goes to a different school, had been shot at her school in an accidental incident, and then his school went into lockdown one day, and this was just a few weeks ago. And he and his friend, these are both 12-year-old kids, they wrote wills. They actually wrote wills saying, you know, if I die in my school, this is who I want to get my stuff. And, you know, that's where we are now.
You know, those personal stories, I think, are also something that's a little bit different this time. We're seeing more of them because of the efforts of journalists like you, because of the efforts of people who are in this room, Ben, Stephanie. You're both working to, all three of you are working to document these things. And they really do kind of get to people in a way that sometimes the breaking news doesn't. Stephanie, you decided to take a series of portraits during the Pittsburgh March. Can you tell us about what they were and why you chose to do it that way?
Sure. I covered the protests in a normal newspaper way. I covered the action and things like that. But in between and when things died down, I noticed that a lot of children and a lot of students had made their own signs. And this was the message that they wanted to communicate to the world. And I wanted to ask more about that. I think that, you know, as far as what John was talking about with trauma, children feel that this is really disrupting their education and their future. And a lot of them feel, and a lot of them said to me that they felt like their voice was discounted because of their age. And with this and with their signs and with getting out there and seeing the numbers and seeing the conversation take hold and the hashtag take off, they're starting to understand their power. And they're realizing that the institutions that write them off or their rhetoric focuses on disempowering them, you know, they'll remember that as they grow into voting age and as they grow into an age where they're voting with their dollars. And so as a photographer and a journalist, I'm interested in not only telling the story, but helping people tell their own story and collaborating with the community, and especially with children who in this situation and in other situations like the opioid crisis and things like that, they're often subject to the decisions, the consequences of the decisions that adults make, but they have little to no say. So I wanted to photograph them with their sign, with what they were projecting to the world, and talk to them about what was important to them and why they were there. There was a group of five siblings from Leechburg who all came with their own handmade signs. And they had school canceled in early March because of a threat of violence on social media. And a 12-year-old Alyssa Foley told me that she said, "We don't want any more deaths. We're here for all the children and teens to feel safe wherever they are." And you know, depending on people's age and people's understanding, they had specific things that they wanted, like specific forms of gun control, but then they also had general things that they wanted, like just feeling safe at school so they can learn.
I think there's something very interesting that Stephanie said, talking about the student's power. I think even as a journalist, I didn't realize that until just recently, and just covering these events over the last, you know, 2 months, that there is a lot of power that they have. And even the reaction, the negative reaction to some of the students, you could argue that that's fear from the other side. Well, fear is because of power, and it's been interesting to watch, and it's going to be something that's going to continue to unfold.
We've mentioned fear a few times here. Ben, very briefly, Woodland Hills has an armed guard. Does that make students feel safer, or do they just walk past a guy with a gun every day?
Well, yeah, they have school resource officers, and I think that they also have a metal detector. I think the security does make students feel safer. A lot of schools don't even have metal detectors. And while I talked to some Woodland Hills students who said they used to complain about waiting in line to get through that metal detector in the morning, but now they're glad they have that security.
John Woodrow Cox is a reporter with The Washington Post. Ben Schmidt is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And Stephanie Strasberg is a photojournalist with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, a woman was killed while crossing the street in Tempe, Arizona, in the first known fatal accident involving a pedestrian and a self-driving car. The car was an Uber, like those the company has been testing on Pittsburgh's roads. The company grounded its fleet nationwide, and the governor of Arizona ordered a halt to testing in his state. In Pennsylvania, though, it's not so simple. That's next when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Pittsburgh Cultural Trust announced dates for the highly anticipated musical Hamilton. The show won't visit the Steel City until January 2019, with tickets going first to subscription holders. And a Pennsylvania high school has been flooded with donations after school board members voted against taking a $5,000 grant from the NRA for its rifle club. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mike Wershagen, in this week for Kevin Gavin. Autonomous cars have been a fixture of Pittsburgh's roads since 2016. That's when Uber started testing its self-driving vehicles in the Strip District. The technology has since been hailed as the future of transportation and an answer to a host of problems caused by human drivers. But a deadly crash in Arizona, the first in which the car's computer was in control, led Uber to ground its self-driving fleet, while local, state, and national authorities try to figure out what went wrong. Here to talk about what happened and what comes next are Laura Bliss, a reporter for the online news outlet CityLab, and 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks so much for having us.
Laura, tell us what happened that night in Arizona.
Sure. We know that an Uber SUV driving in autonomous mode was traveling at about 40 miles per hour down a fairly vacant 7-lane road in Tempe, Arizona, when it struck Elaine Herzberg, who was crossing that road outside of a crosswalk pushing her bike. The car, as far as we know from police reports, made no attempts to stop or brake, and Herzberg was killed.
Do we know what went wrong?
We don't yet, although there are a number of signs. Clearly, there was, a failure in the technology itself. Pretty much every AV expert out there has just expressed bafflement, at the fact that this car, under those conditions, fairly good lighting, broad, empty road, would not detect a moving pedestrian, because everything we know about the radar systems that these cars use, should be able to do that. And then, of course, there's also seems to be a failure on the part of the operator, right? We know that her hands were not on the wheel or near the wheel as they're supposed to be, and her eyes were not on the road.
Arizona's Governor Doug Ducey suspended Uber's ability to test its self-driving cars in the state. Margaret, what's been the reaction here?
Sure. So in Pennsylvania, self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles, are governed by the Pennsylvania Vehicle Code, which may limit what Pennsylvania can do, because like all other vehicles on Pennsylvania roads, Ubers, or not just Uber, but all companies testing self-driving cars have to have an operator in the vehicle. And so that operator, that driver, is responsible like any other car on the road would be. And so Pennsylvania can't just yank all self-driving operations off of its roads. Governor Tom Wolf has said that his main priority is safety. A spokesperson for his office said that PennDOT will work with Uber in advance of any resumption of testing. Mayor Bill Peduto has also expressed concern, but also expressed hope that ultimately autonomous vehicles will prevent the thousands of fatalities that happen each year with cars. And in fact, has said that it's to be expected that there will be accidents along the way in the development of this technology.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that Pennsylvania law is effectively silent on the issue of self-driving cars. I mean, it's just not something lawmakers thought that they were going to have to deal with until pretty recently. And that gives these companies an awful lot of leeway. Laura, you've talked to a couple of Uber's vehicle testers. So what did they tell you about the training they go through?
You know, one can kind of gain some level of sympathy for these operators. I spoke with a couple of three now former AV operators, and they really described a quite grueling regimen where, you know, their shifts last 8 to 10 hours. They're often driving night shifts and often driving on the same loops over and over and over and over again. Recently, Uber also reduced the number of operators per vehicle from 2 to 1. So there's really no stimulation. And quite a lot of research at this point has pointed to how humans really quickly, you know, lose our ability to stay focused and stimulated when, you know, we're in a situation where technology is doing most of the work for us. It actually gets harder for our muscles and our eyes to react to hazards on the road in a driving scenario. So there are, you know, signs here and certainly testimonies from former drivers that suggest, you know, one of them even told me that they saw an accident like this coming.
It was really interesting to read in the New York Times and in your reporting, Laura, about this reduction of 2 operators to 1. I had some questions about that in Pittsburgh, and a spokesperson here told me at the time that that only happens in vehicles equipped with the latest and greatest technology. It's a new iPad interface, that they don't need 2 operators. They can just have 1. And I was curious if that presented a safety concern. And again, at the time, this was about a month and a month and a half ago, she said, no, because they undergo rigorous safety training. And so to know the kinds of monotony that the operators are facing, you know, it's nice to have a partner if you, you know, stray from attention, which, as Laura points out, it's so human to do.
Yeah, that was a remarkable thing to read, that a tester actually said to you, we saw this coming. Is this what they were talking about?
Partly, yes. I mean, you know, to be sure that the operators I spoke with, you know, are no longer working with Uber. And so, you know, they may have their own feelings about their experience there and the company itself. So, you know, that's to be understood for sure. But, you know, my understanding is that, and in Pittsburgh included, that, you know, more drivers than not are driving independently, and that more than one have expressed concerns about the sort of conditions that drivers are operating in.
Margaret, this was not the first incident involving a self-driving Uber. They've grounded their fleet twice before. Is that correct?
Yes. So in September of 2017, in Pittsburgh, they grounded the fleet for a few hours after an incident. And then in March of 2017, so about a year ago, there was another crash in Arizona. Operations were suspended and then resumed 3 days later.
So after Uber grounded its fleet this time, after this fatal accident, another company testing these vehicles, NVIDIA, also pulled their vehicles off the road, but others are still out there. I mean, we've got Argo AI on Pittsburgh's roads, right?
Sure, and Aptiv as well, formerly Delphi. As far as I know, there are no change in plans in their self-driving operations.
Have they talked about why that is? I mean, are these systems really that different, or do we just not know?
I can't speak to why or why not they are not changing their self-driving operations or halting them in some fashion. Most of these self-driving systems are a mix of cameras and radar and long-range radar. I mean, in the world of technology, this is like eons ago. But back in September, I had a chance to exchange correspondence with the chief technology officer for Aptiv, formerly Delphi, and he said at that time that each individual sensor has its weaknesses, but together they can create and gather the level of information needed to operate on real roads with, you know, real-time driving. And so basic sensing capability, again, this was back in September, still needs some work, but together, generally, the elements allow for a pretty robust system of sensing.
And we just saw a report either today or yesterday that showed Uber has actually reduced the number of sensors that it has on each vehicle in newer kind of crops of its self-driving technology. So there's kind of been, according to internal documents that have come out, right, there was at some point sort of a move away from what was considered by some of the leaders of the AV development group, kind of an overabundance of caution on the sensor front. And now we don't know what caused the crash from a technological standpoint yet, but that is something that's come up.
Right. It's not clear yet whether that's why, as Laura said, if that's why that happened in Arizona. But also back in September at the Advanced Technologies Group, here in Pittsburgh, they were still having some trouble sensing cyclists or pedestrians on the sides of the cars, which I think is interesting.
It is, yeah, and that's something they've had here. That's something that people in San Francisco had raised an issue with. Now, this is the first fatal accident involving a self-driving vehicle, but as we spoke about before, there have been other times when they've felt a need to ground their fleet. When something like this happens, though, when it's a much more serious event, there's a range of ways companies can respond, right? Ranging from just total radio silence to complete transparency. Laura, where's Uber on that spectrum?
They've totally grounded all self-driving testing in all five cities, and that includes the trucks that they just recently launched. That's a sort of whole separate program. They've issued formal apologies, and just today there was news that Uber settled with the family of the victim, Elaine Hertzberg, in this incident. I guess there is some contrition on Uber's part, if I could put it that way. And it's unclear at this point, how they will move forward once the investigation is wrapped. I think it entirely depends on what the investigation reveals.
Do we know anything about the terms of that settlement?
They said there will be no further comment from the victim's family, and they are not disclosing details at this time.
So in this environment, this is a new technology, and there have been very few incidents, but whenever one happens, everybody pays attention to it. Margaret, do people trust self-driving cars?
That's a great question. In Pittsburgh, there was a survey that was conducted back in the spring of 2017 by a local nonprofit called Bike Pittsburgh. And they asked cyclists and pedestrians and other drivers whether they felt safe driving around self-driving cars. And they did not expect to get a lot of yeses, but a lot of people said, yeah, robots don't get angry, and they tend to follow the rules of the road. But at the same time, they were concerned that maybe they weren't passing cyclists well, that you couldn't tell whether a human was driving or whether a robot was driving. So I think there is some positivity, and certainly a lot of people who do express belief in the idea that this will ultimately make us all safer. These are painful incidents in the interim.
Okay, so where do we go from here? Are people talking about new laws because of this crash? Has it made legislators or regulators pay a little more attention to this technology? Laura, have you heard any movement on that front?
It's interesting. There hasn't been, as far as I have seen or heard, a kind of clear indication by states or cities, for that matter, that this incident, will give rise to or needs to give rise to, new safety regulations right away. Certainly, we've seen in Arizona there is a ban on Uber testing its autonomous vehicles. Uber also voluntarily declined to renew its application to test in California, which has been one of the sort of harder pushing states in terms of regulation. But it's sort of striking that there hasn't been a huge response.
Officials in Pennsylvania have said it's so hard for the government to keep up with innovation. But there is a Senate bill in the Pennsylvania Senate, a bill that would further regulate automated vehicle testing or platooning testing as well. It's currently in committee. Governor Wolf is pushing for action, basically to as his spokesperson put it, improve the oversight and make sure that all the entities are working together to make safety the highest priority. But we'll see what happens.
And there are kind of a lot of unknowns here. I mean, the settlement with between Uber and the family of the woman who was killed, that, you know, you could see a sort of a direct line from the accident to who was responsible. It's an Uber vehicle. It's Uber technology. But as these cars move into private hands, when there is an accident with a self-driving car, whose fault is it? Is it the driver behind the wheel? Is it the auto manufacturer who made this system? Do we know the answers to these questions yet? Laura?
It's an incredibly interesting question, and it's really not clear yet. And it'll depend, I think, whether the future of driving is shared or not, right? I think there's a sort of split in the automotive and technology development worlds, right, as to whether, you know, self-driving cars are going to be something that essentially replaces everybody's, you know, single occupancy vehicle, right, the cars that they own and that we drive every day to work and back, or, you know, if there's kind of a new model that's emerging here where the cars are sort of fleets that are owned by companies like Uber or like Waymo or Ford or GM for that matter, and where this becomes sort of more of a shared mode.
All right. Laura Bliss is a reporter for CityLab, an online news outlet through Atlantic Media, and Margaret J. Krause covers development and transportation for 90.5 WESA. Thank you both.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to talk.
Thank you both.
Coming up, it's opening day for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Yesterday's opener in Detroit was postponed due to rain. What are the odds for the Buccos in 2018, and what, if anything, can management do to repair relations with unhappy fans? That's next when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Monongahela Navigation Company is chartered in 1836 to help design and build the region's lock and dam system. The Pittsburgh engineers behind the organization were some of the earliest to experiment with regulating inland waters. Now, there are 23 lock and dam systems on the Allegheny, Monongahela, and Ohio rivers. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for March 30th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mike Wershagen, in this week for Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Pirates opened their season today after getting rained out in Detroit on Thursday. Not long ago, the Pirates set a professional sports record by notching 20 consecutive losing seasons. But then there was a rebirth. A team Pittsburgh could get excited about. A team worthy of the best ballpark in baseball. And for a few glorious years, the Pirates were winners again. Last couple of years, not so much. Then came this last offseason. Within a few days, the Pirates traded two of their brightest stars, Gerrit Cole, a young ace, and Andrew McCutchen, the man who brought winning baseball back to the Berg. Fans are, to tell you what fans are, we have Sean Gentile of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and Charlie Deitch, editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
Sean, can you run us through what happened during this offseason?
I think everybody knew that this was going to be the offseason where the franchise had to pay the piper. I think people knew that a McCutchen deal wasn't just likely but certain. He'd been on the trading block, you know, in one way or another, really since the year before, and certainly Gerrit Cole seemed on his way out as well. So those 2 days or 3 days over the winter, I don't think they were unexpected, but that doesn't change how angry they made people. So they hit the reset button, and now here we are on the verge of another mediocre season, it seems.
Can you put those two guys in context for us? I mean, who are they and how do they stack up in the league?
Andrew McCutchen is maybe not a generational player league wide, but In terms of this franchise, he's certainly the best that we've seen here since Barry Bonds in the early 90s, and he's the caliber of player that isn't going to come around anytime soon. He's a legitimate MVP candidate, and beyond that, the charisma that he brought to the table and those sort of, you know, less tangible things that were really necessary to get people excited here about baseball again. That he is more than anybody else responsible for the rebirth of baseball in the city. It's Andrew McCutchen, and there's really no close second place. So he's the full package in terms of talent and just overall importance. I think to the fan base. Gerrit Cole is a little bit more complicated. He's the number one overall pick. He, you know, three years before this, he got some Cy Young votes, but never quite lived up to the billing of a number one pick. He showed flashes, but there was some inconsistency and certainly some frustration. I think on the part of the fan base. But at the end of the day, you know, he was still certainly their most talented pitcher and really their best over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and you mentioned that he had this that Andrew McCutchen had this charisma and that he was, you know, somebody who really rallied people around the team and really around the city. I mean, when he left, he wrote what looked like a love letter to Pittsburgh. It was something to read. Charlie, you recently interviewed a few superfans.
We did, yeah.
Yeah, who'd you talk to?
Well, we talked to just some fans who we put out a call, and we talked to Javé Brown. She's an assistant football coach at North Hills High School. We talked to Harvey Mazel, who's been a Pirates fan since 1969, I believe, and he actually moved to Pittsburgh to be closer to the Pirates, took a job here. And then some other folks who just, you know, they're on the message boards all the time, so they're really watching the team closely, but they're watching from a fan's perspective and not a journalist's perspective.
So what did they have to say?
They're ticked off, you know. The biggest thing that I heard was, why not just let McCutchen play out the final year, or at least let McCutchen start the season, and then see what happens from there? I mean, there's no question that I think the Pirates could have signed Andrew McCutchen. They obviously, that's not how they do business, as we all know. They don't spend money. But I think there's just sort of a despair for a lot of these fans going into the season. And a lot of them, I will say, a lot of them weren't too concerned about Gerrit Cole, because I don't think Gerrit Cole ever really clicked with fans the way that some other guys did. And like, I think that Jameson Taillon is probably going to prove to be every bit the pitcher that Gerrit Cole is. And I think that he's got a story and a background that fans can really grab onto. So yeah, people are really, they've always talked about, we're not going to the games, but I think that that's going to happen this year. I mean, we're seeing it now. What are we, 3 days from the home opener? And the secondary market on tickets is, you can go onto a secondary sales spot and get a ticket for $30. I mean, it's just, and there are still tickets, I think, for sale on the Pirates site. So there are plenty of good seats available, and that's the way I think that fans are finally going to get through to ownership.
You mentioned that, you know, this is just not the way the Pirates do business. Yeah. Owner Bob Nutting has said that, you know, this is a small market team. He says this is the way it's going to be unless the economics of baseball change. Sean, is that correct? I mean, is he really boxed in like that?
I think it's a chicken or egg situation where, you know, you say that fans should come and then payroll increases. You know, it's this sort of feedback cycle that we've seen bear out over the last couple of years. Yes, the Pirates are behind the eight ball a bit when it comes down to the MLB economics, but at the end of the day, you know, something that this fan base and that this city was sold for years and years was that when they're good, they'll pay what it takes, and that didn't happen. And I think that's the root of a lot of the anger and a lot of the frustration is that there was this sense, you know, and you can call it hubris on the part of the front office or ownership or whatever, but there is a fundamental misunderstanding of their position within the league. And I think they thought that the biggest mistake that they ever made was thinking that the success that they had from 2014 and 2015 was repeatable, because it wasn't. There were so many things that coagulated at the right time, whether it was McCutchen being an MVP caliber player, whether it was Gerrit Cole for all his warts, or like really at the peak of his game that we saw, all these things, you know, had to coalesce at the same time. And that's when they should have bought. And you could sense it then that, you know, for better or worse, that they didn't quite appreciate what they had. And now it's gone. and they're trying to restart the process.
So when Bob Nutting says something like that, I mean, do fans buy it?
No, not at all. Because again, he had his chance to prove that, okay, if you guys come to games, you know, we'll have the money to put a team in. So attendance has not been horrible. I mean, through the worst of the Pirates streak since they moved into PNC Park, the fans still came. They put together a couple of great seasons. They didn't spend money midseason to bring anybody in to close the deal. And then this offseason, you know, they get rid of McCutcheon. I think the Corey Dickerson signing was kind of a bit of placation on the part of ownership. They're like, well, look, you know, Corey Dickerson's good. We're going to bring him in. Well, it's like, well, Andrew McCutcheon was good too. And, you know, so what's the difference there? So, you know, it's just the way the Nuttings do business. I used to work for a Nutting newspaper. And granted, the salaries are a lot lower, but I ran a Nutting newspaper. And it's the same way that they do business at their newspapers. Get me bottom dollar and bring it in. And that's how we're going to run. And that's how we're going to maximize profits.
Yeah, I think in Charlie and I were talking about this, you know, before we came in the studio. One of the cardinal sins that they made was after the 2015 season. They're coming off a 98 win year. AJ Burnett, who was in a really important part of that rotation, he retired. Jay Happ, who was in their defense a big deadline acquisition. He left in free agency, and that was the time coming off the season that they did or that they'd put together. To put money back in the team, particularly in the starting rotation, and they didn't. They went dumpster diving and figured that they could find reclamation projects, which again they're good at that, and they do deserve some amount of credit for it. But to me, that's when the jig was up. That's when people should have realized that they're not that. You know, there is a bit of a bait and switch that happened. So I think the light bulb should have went off then. And I think for a lot of people it did, honestly. So the winner, and this goes back to the first question, I think the winner was the culmination of this 2-year slide from where they were after the 2015 year.
So how did the owners get back in the fans' good graces?
Spend money. I mean, put a winner on the team if that means you've got, you know, if you know, Uncle Ray has another reclamation project in him. I mean, you know, the problem is, you know, they would get these guys, they would rehab these guys, but then they wouldn't sign them. I mean, J.A. Happ was a monster.
And you can't expect a pitching coach to continually do that. I mean, the fact that he has done it and will do it at some point again is impressive, but, like, you can't, you know, you can't stake your bets on all that by itself. But I think the bit... Charlie, if they spend money, that'd be great. But the biggest thing that the ownership group could do to curry favor with the fans is to sell the team. And I think that's the big question. And that's, like, this existential question surrounding this franchise is, if you don't want to spend the money, and if it is about the money, then cash out and sell your professional sports team, whether it's for $1 billion or $600 million or whatever. If you don't want to spend the money that it takes to assemble a championship caliber franchise, that's fine, but cash out. There's plenty of money. There's plenty of money in the sale of the team.
All right. Sean Gentile is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Charlie Deitch is editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Pardon me. Research and production assistance from Zakia Madian. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Kevin Gavin will be back with you next week. Until next time, I'm Mike Wershagen. Hope you have a good week of good news.